Chapter 47. My fellows? The peasantry, my fellows? Cried the other. I'd have you know, my young master, that I come of a long and honorable line of cloth merchants that have had their names on the guild for 200 years and over. I've nothing to do with the peasantry, thank God. The youth had emptied another glass. W what? He screamed. You deny the universal kinship of man? You disown your starving brothers? Proud tyrant, remember the Bastille. He burst into tears, and began to quote Alfieri. Well, said the fat man, turning a disgusted shoulder on this display of emotion, to my mind this business of draining Pontesordo is too much like telling the Almighty what to do. If God made the land wet, what right have we to dry it? Those that begin by meddling with the Creator's works may end by laying hands on the Creator. You're right, said another. There's no knowing where these newfangled notions may land us. For my part, I was rather taken by them at first, but since I find that His Highness, to pay for all His good works, is cutting down His household and throwing decent people out of a job like my own son, for instance, that was one of the understeward's boys at the palace, why, since then, I begin to see a little farther into the game. A shabby, shrewd-looking fellow in a dirty coat and snuff-stained stock had sauntered up to the table and stood listening with an amused smile. Ah, said the scribe, glancing up, here's a thoroughgoing reformer who'll be asking us all to throw up our hats for the new charter. The newcomer laughed contemptuously. Aye, he said. God forbid. The new charter's none of my making. It's only another dodge for getting round the populace for appearing, to give them what they would rise up and take, if it were denied them any longer. Why, I thought you were hot for these reforms, exclaimed the fat man with surprise. The other shrugged. Why, you might as well say I was in favor of having the sun rise tomorrow. It would probably rise at the same hour, if I voted against it. Reform is bound to come, whether your dukes and princes are for it or against it, and those that grant constitutions instead of refusing them are like men who tie a string to their hats before going out in a gale. The string may hold for a while, but if it blows hard enough the hats will all come off in the end. And meanwhile we furnish the string from our own pockets, said the scribe with a chuckle. The shabby man grinned. It won't be the last thing to come out of your pockets, said he, turning to push his way toward another table. The others rose and called for their reckoning, and the listener on the cask slipped out of his corner, elbowed a passage to the door, and stepped forth into the square. It was after midnight, a thin drizzle was falling, and the crowd had scattered. The rain was beginning to extinguish the paper lanterns and the torches, and the canvas sides of the tents flapped dismally, like wet sheets on a clothesline. The man drew his cloak closer, and avoiding the stragglers who crossed his path, turned into the first street that led to the palace. He walked fast over the slippery cobblestones, buffeted by a rising wind and threading his way between dark walls and sleeping house fronts till he reached the lane below the Ducal Gardens. He unlocked the door by which he had come forth, entered the gardens, and paused a moment on the terrace above the lane. Behind him rose the palace, a dark irregular bulk, with a lighted window showing here and there. Before him lay the city, an indistinguishable huddle of roofs and towers under the rainy night. He stood a while gazing out over it, then he turned and walked toward the palace. The garden alleys were deserted, the pleached walks dark as subterranean passages, with the wet gleam of statues starting spectrally out of the blackness. The man walked rapidly, leaving the Borromini wing on his left, and skirting the outstanding mass of the older buildings. Behind the marble buttresses of the chapel, he crossed the dense obscurity of a court between high walls, found a door under an archway, turned a key in the lock, and gained a spiral stairway as dark as the court. He groped his way up the stairs, and paused a moment on the landing to listen. Then he opened another door, lifted a heavy hanging of tapestry, and stepped into the duke's closet. It stood empty, with a lamp burning low on the desk. The man threw off his cloak and hat, dropped into a chair beside the desk, and hid his face in his hands. 4.9. It was the eve of the Duke's birthday. A cabinet council had been called in the morning, and His Highness's ministers had submitted to him the revised draft of the constitution which was to be proclaimed on the morrow. Throughout the conference, which was brief and formal, Odo had been conscious of a subtle change in the ministerial atmosphere. Instead of the current of resistance against which he had grown used to forcing his way, he became aware of a tacit yielding to his will. Tresker had apparently withdrawn his opposition to the charter, and the other ministers had followed suit. To Odo's overwrought imagination, there was something ominous in the change. He had counted on the goad of opposition to fight off the fatal languor which he had learned to expect at such crises. Now that he found there was to be no struggle, he understood how largely his zeal had of late depended on such factitious incentives. He felt an irrational longing to throw himself on the other side of the conflict, to tear in bits the paper awaiting his signature, and disown the policy which had dictated it. But the tide of acquiescence on which he was afloat was no stagnant backwater of indifference, but the glassy reach just above the fall of a river. The current was as swift as it was smooth, and he felt himself hurried forward to an end he could no longer escape. He took the pen which Tresker handed him, and signed the Constitution. The meeting over, he summoned Gamba. He felt the need of such encouragement as the hunchback alone could give. Fulvia's enthusiasms were too unreal, too abstract. She lived in a region of ideals, whence ugly facts were swept out by some process of mental housewifery which kept her world perpetually smiling and immaculate. Gamba, at least, fed his convictions on facts. If his outlook was narrow, it was direct. No roseate medium of fancy was interposed between his vision and the truth. He stood listening thoughtfully, while Odo poured forth his doubts. "Your Highness may well hesitate," he said at last. "There are always more good reasons against a new state of things than for it. I am not surprised that Count Tresker appears to have withdrawn his opposition. I believe he now honestly wishes Your Highness to proclaim the Constitution." Odo looked up in surprise. "Why, you do not mean that he has come to believe in it?" Gamba smiled. "Probably not in Your Highness's sense, but he may have found a use of his own for it." "What do you mean?" Odo asked. "If he does not believe it will benefit the state, he may think it will injure Your Highness." "Ah," said the Duke slowly. There was a pause, during which he was possessed by the same shuddering reluctance to fix his mind on the facts before him as when he had questioned the hunchback about Mamola's death. He longed to cast the whole business aside, to be up and away from it, drawing breath in a new world, where every air was not tainted with corruption. He raised his head with an effort. "You think, then, that the liberals are secretly acting against me in this matter?" "I am persuaded of it, Your Highness." Odo hesitated. "Why, you have always told me," he began again, "that the love of dominion was your brother's ruling passion. If he really believes this movement will be popular with the people, why should he secretly oppose it, instead of making the most of his own share in it as the minister of a popular sovereign?" "For several reasons," Gamba answered promptly. "In the first place, the reforms Your Highness has introduced are not of his own choosing, and Tresker has little sympathy with any policy he has not dictated. In the second place, the powers and opportunities of a constitutional minister are too restricted to satisfy his appetite for rule. And thirdly," he paused a moment, as though doubtful how his words would be received, "suspect Tresker of having a private score against Your Highness, which he would be glad to pay off publicly." Odo fell silent, yielding himself to a fresh current of thought. "I know not what score he may have against me," he said at length, but what injures me must injure the state, and if Tresker has any such motive for withdrawing his opposition, it must be because he believes the Constitution will defeat its own ends. He does believe that, assuredly, but he is not the only one of your Highness's ministers. That would ruin the state on the chance of finding an opportunity among the ruins. That is as it may be, said Odo with a touch of weariness. I have seen enough of human ambition to learn how limited and unimaginative a passion it is. If it saw farther, I should fear it more. But if it is short-sighted, it sees clearly at close range. And the motive you ascribe to Tresker would imply that he believes the Constitution will be a failure. Without doubt, your Highness. I am convinced that your ministers have done all they could to prevent the proclamation of the Charter, and failing that, to thwart its workings, if it be proclaimed. In this they have gone hand in hand with the clergy, and their measures have been well taken. But I do not believe that any state of mind produced by external influences can long withstand the natural drift of opinion. And your Highness may be sure that, though the talkers and writers are mostly against you in this matter, the mass of the people are with you. Odo answered with a despairing gesture. How can I be sure, when the people have no means of expressing their needs? It is like trying to guess the wants of a deaf and dumb man. The hunchback flushed suddenly. The people will not always be deaf and dumb, he said. Someday they will speak. Not in my day, said Odo wearily. And meanwhile we blunder on, without ever really knowing what incalculable instincts and prejudices are pitted against us. You and your party tell me the people are sick of the burdens the clergy lay on them, yet their blind devotion to the church is manifest at every turn, and it did not need the business of the Virgin's crown to show me how little reason and justice can avail against such influences. Gamber replied by an impatient gesture. As to the Virgin's crown, he said, your Highness must have guessed it was one of the friar's tricks. A last expedient to turn the people against you. I was not bred up by a priest for nothing. I know what past masters those gentry are in raising ghosts and reading portents. They know the minds of the poor folk as the herdsman knows the habits of his cattle. And for generations they have used that knowledge to bring the people more completely under their control. And what have we to oppose to such a power? Odo exclaimed. We are fighting the battle of ideas against passions, of reflection against instinct. And you have but to look in the human heart to guess which side will win in such a struggle. We have science and truth and common sense with us, you say yes. But the church has love and fear and tradition, and the solidarity of nigh 2,000 years of dominion. Gamba listened in respectful silence. Then he replied with a faint smile, all that your Highness says is true. But I beg leave to relate to your Highness a tale which I read lately in an old book of your library. According to this story, it appears that, when the early Christians of Alexandria set out to destroy the pagan idols in the temples, they were seized with great dread at sight of the god Serapis. For even those that did not believe in the old gods feared them, and none dared raise a hand against the sacred image. But suddenly a soldier who was bolder than the rest flung his battle axe at the figure, and when it broke in pieces, there rushed out nothing worse than a great company of rats. The Duke had promised to visit Fulvia that evening. For several days his state of indecision had made him find pretexts for avoiding her, but now that the charter was signed, and he had ordered its proclamation, he craved the contact of her unwavering faith. He found her alone in the dusk of the convent parlor, but he had hardly crossed the threshold before he was aware of an indefinable change in his surroundings. She advanced with an impulsiveness out of harmony with the usual tranquility of their meetings, and he felt her hand tremble and burn in his. In the twilight it seemed to him that her very dress had a warmer rustle and glimmer, that there emanated from her glance and movements some heady fragrance of a long past summer. He smiled to think that this phantom coquetry should have risen at the summons of an academic degree. But some deeper sense in him was stirred, as by a vision of waste riches adrift on the dim seas of chance. For a moment she sat silent, as in the days when they had been too near each other for many words, and there was something indescribably soothing in this dreamlike return to the past. It was he who roused himself first. "How young you look," he said, giving involuntary utterance to his thought. "Do I?" she answered gaily. "I am glad of that, for I feel extraordinarily young tonight. Perhaps it is because I have been thinking a great deal of the old days of Venice and Turin, and of the high road to Vercelli, for instance." She glanced at him with a smile. "Do you know," she went on, moving to a seat at his side, and laying a hand on the arm of his chair, "that there is one secret of mine you have never guessed in all these years?" Odo returned her smile. "What is it, I wonder?" he said. She fixed him with bright bantering eyes. I knew why you deserted us at Vercelli." He uttered an exclamation, but she lifted a hand to his lips. "Ah, how angry I was then, but why be angry now? It all happened so long ago, and if it had not happened, who knows? Perhaps you would never have pitied me enough to love me as you did." She laughed softly, reminiscently, leaning back as if to let the tide of memories ripple over her. Then she raised her head suddenly, and said in a changed voice, "Are your plans fixed for tomorrow?" Odo glanced at her in surprise. Her mind seemed to move as capriciously as Maria Clementina's. "The Constitution is signed," he answered, "and my ministers proclaim it tomorrow morning." He looked at her a moment, and lifted her hand to his lips. "Everything has been done according to your wishes," he said. She drew away with a start, and he saw that as he had turned pale. "And no, not as I wish," she murmured. "It must not be because I wish," she broke off and her hand slipped from his. "You have taught me to wish as you wish," he answered gently. "As surely you would not disown your pupil now?" Her agitation increased. "Do not call yourself that," she exclaimed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.